Welcome to the deep dive. We're looking at this really interesting transcript from a meditation class with Brother Teo Kian-kun.
That's right.
And our goal today, well, it's really to get into these teachings, isn't it? To kind of pull out the practical stuff, the insights about meditation that can actually, help clarify things.
Exactly. And what's so valuable here is it's a direct transcript. It's pretty much unfiltered.
Like being in the room.
Almost, yeah.
Yeah.
We're getting the teaching directly.
Okay, so let's jump in. He starts with something the Buddha apparently called the most important quality of mind, heedfulness, appamatta.
Appamatta, yes.
And he makes this, wow, really strong statement saying that lacking it is like being spiritually dead.
It really grabs your attention, doesn't it?
It does. So this whole deep dive is kind of framed around understanding that. So what is heedfulness really at its core?
Well, think of it less like just passively noticing things and more like the active ingredient, the thing that turns just plain experience into, well, into wisdom. It's about striving, but doing it with awareness, with mindfulness. It's active.
Active ingredient. I like that phrasing. So why this one quality? Why did the Buddha apparently see it as the most fundamental thing?
The transcript really emphasizes this, that the Buddha put it right at the foundation. It's the bedrock, you know. Everything else is built on top of it.
Huh.
Without heedfulness, spiritual growth just doesn't happen.
And this is the bit that really got me. It's not just for when you're sitting on a cushion meditating, is it?
Not at all. That's crucial.
It sounds like it touches everything we do.
Exactly. Brother Teo explains that once you really get the essence of heedfulness, everything becomes stama. Your whole life becomes the teaching in action.
Wow.
It's about shifting your whole perspective. So even, you know, washing the dishes or making an offering becomes a mindful practice.
Okay, give me an example. Like, say, doing puja, making an offering. How does heedfulness change that?
Right. So the transcript paints this picture. Instead of just going through the motions, like on autopilot.
Yeah.
Heedfulness means bringing awareness to it all. Feeling your hands, noticing the offering itself, being clear about your intention behind giving.
Ah, the intention.
Exactly. When you infuse it with that kind of mindful attention, even a routine thing like puja becomes this really powerful practice. It builds faith, joy,
yeah,
and more heedfulness. It's about the quality you bring to it.
So it's that deliberate awareness that elevates it. And those Dhammapada verses he quotes, they really hit hard. Heedfulness is the path to the deathless. The heedful never die.
Whereas heedlessness is the path of the dead, and the heedless are as if dead. It's a very stark contrast.
It is. And the other verse, 23.
Yeah, that reinforces it, saying the constantly meditative and ever mindful will realize nibbana. So heedfulness isn't just some nice idea. It's presented as the actual path to liberation.
Okay, so heedfulness is the foundation. What's the goal then? Where is this specific meditation practice, as Brother Teo explains it, actually heading?
The goal is Vipassana meditation. And its specific purpose is to develop insight, deep insight, into those three universal characteristics.
Right, the big three. Impermanence.
Anicca, yeah. Then suffering, or that inherent unsatisfactoriness, dukkha.
Dukkha.
And non-self, anatta, the absence of a fixed, separate self.
So it's not really about, say, achieving some amazing state of concentration or feeling energy fields or something.
Not primarily, no. The emphasis here is squarely on wisdom. On waking up to how things actually are.
Seeing reality, Clint.
Spot on. Not how we wish it was or how we imagine it to be.
And the result of getting that insight through Vipassana, what changes?
Well, the transcript says this understanding directly cuts through delusion, especially that core delusion of having a permanent independent self.
Ah, okay.
And dismantling those illusions, that's what leads to Nibbana, to the end of suffering.
Right. So if heedfulness is where we start and the Vipassana insight is the goal, what gets in the way? Why isn't it just a straightforward journey?
Ah, well, that brings us neatly to the five mental hindrances.
The roadblocks.
Exactly. Brother Teo explains that heedlessness often arises because these hindrances are actively clouding the mind. They block that inner peace and stop mindfulness from developing properly.
Like static on the radio.
That's a great analogy. Yeah, you can't hear the clear signal because of the static.
Okay, so let's list them. What are these five sources of mental static?
First two are sensual desire and ill will.
The wanting and the hating.
Pretty much. They come from how we habitually react to everything we sense. Always wanting the nice stuff, pushing away the unpleasant stuff. That constant push-pull.
Makes sense. We waste so much energy on that. What's hindrance number three?
That's sloth and torpor. It's that heavy, sluggish feeling. Mental, physical lethargy. no motivation. The transcript uses a really good analogy, actually falling asleep in a physics class because you just don't get it or don't see why it matters.
Oh, I definitely know that feeling. Okay, number four.
Restlessness and worry. This comes from, you know, fear, anxiety. And often, the transcript points out, from just a general lack of order in our lives, internally and externally.
Disorder leads to a restless mind.
Yeah, there's a quote from Krishnamurti in there about living a life of disorder. It really makes sense that it would stir up the mind.
It does hit home. When things feel chaotic outside, my mind definitely reflects that. Okay, the last one, number five.
Doubt, which isn't just questioning. It's more like a lack of understanding, a wavering faith in the path itself. And Brother Teo makes a really key distinction here.
Between
blind faith, just accepting stuff, and true faith, or confidence, sada, which actually grows from investigating, from understanding things for yourself.
So investigating leads to stable faith.
Exactly. That's the idea.
Okay, so these five, desire, ill will, sloth torpor, restlessness, worry, and doubt, they create this mental fog. Now, how do we deal with them? Just grit our teeth and try to push them down?
Well, interestingly, no. The transcript suggests that fighting them directly, trying to suppress them, that's often not very effective. It can even backfire.
Right.
Instead, the approach is more about actively cultivating their opposites.
Ah, the positive approach. So what are these opposites? These spiritual faculties?
Yes, the five spiritual faculties. The first is sada, that faith or confident conviction we just talked about.
Okay.
Confidence in the Buddha, the Dhamma, the Sangha. And the transcript says you nurture this through things like puja, but done with understanding. With reflection, like mindfully appreciating a clean Buddha image, just noticing the qualities it represents. That kind of strong, informed faith is seen as the start of understanding.
Like trusting the map because you see evidence, it works.
That's a good way to put it, yeah.
Okay, faith first. What's next?
Virya. This is energy, spiritual zeal, persistence, tenacity.
To get up and go.
Sort of, yeah. It arises when you start to understand the Buddha's qualities and the real potential of the teachings to change things. It's the inner drive that keeps you cultivating.
So faith sparks it, zeal fuels it. Third faculty.
Sati, mindfulness itself.
Right.
And the transcript suggests this actually develops quite naturally through practice, like showing respect, training the mind to be quiet. It's that slow shift from living heedlessly to being more aware moment by moment.
The more you practice paying attention, the more it becomes second nature. Makes sense. And number four.
Samadhi.
Yeah.
Often translated as concentration, but maybe it's better understood here as collectedness, a stable, unwavering mind.
But a deeper mindfulness.
Yeah, a stabilized mindfulness. And this collected state is crucial for seeing things clearly without all the usual mental chatter and distortion.
So attention gets stable and clear. And the final one, the fifth.
Panya, wisdom. This grows as sati and samadhi mature. It leads to that clear, penetrating understanding of reality. And importantly, to equanimity, upekkha.
Upekkha.
That balanced, accepting attitude towards whatever comes up. It's directly seeing what is without judging, clinging, or resisting.
Wow. It sounds like they all work together, these faculties, like a positive feedback loop.
They really do.
And how do they deal with those hindrances we talked about?
Well, when these faculties are strong, the hindrances just naturally fade. They lose their grip. Like faith sada directly counters doubt. Zeal virya pushes out sloth and torpor. Mindfulness sati settles restlessness and worry.
Okay.
That collectedness samadhi helps calm down the reactivity of desire and ill will. And wisdom panya, well, that tackles the basic ignorance that fuels all the hindrances in the first place.
It's elegant, actually. You don't fight the darkness, you turn on the light.
That's a perfect way to put it. Cultivate the positive.
Okay, so we know what to cultivate. How do we actually do it? What are the practical steps Brother Teo suggests for undoing that heedless thinking and building awareness?
It starts even before formal sitting with things like puja, reflecting on the teachings, contemplation, and consciously invoking merits, those positive mental states.
Right.
But a really key point he makes is during the actual meditation sitting, you're not trying to know or figure things out intellectually.
Ah, so you don't analyze while meditating.
No, you just observe, experience, the reflection, the analysis that comes after.
Experience first, got her.
And mindfulness itself is described as silent awareness. Awareness without thought, running commentary.
Silent awareness.
Yeah. And the transcript introduces this awareness-based approach with like four key parts. First, learn to relax into whatever state your mind is in. Don't fight it.
Okay, relax into it.
Second, just be aware of these states non-judgmentally. Third, try to sustain that awareness, keep it going,
Yeah.
ideally, throughout the day.
Wow, 24 hours.
Theoretically.
Theoretically. And fourth, once those first three start to feel stable, just trust the process. Let it unfold.
And he gives this specific instruction. Don't try to be aware or mindful. That sounds weird. Why not?
Because the moment you think, okay, I need to be mindful now, that thought itself
just gets in the way.
Exactly. It's another layer of thinking about awareness rather than just being aware. True mindfulness, he suggests, arises more spontaneously when you let go of the trying. Okay, that's subtle, but really important. So what if your mind is just super busy, overwhelmed by those hindrances? Where do you even start?
For that, the transcript suggests a foundational practice, the mind-sweeping method. It's a way to start deconditioning that restless, heedless thinking.
Mind-sweeping. How does that work?
You get into a relaxed, stable posture. Then you systematically guide your attention through the body. Start at the forehead. Feel any tension, relax it.
Okay.
Then gently sweep down eye muscles, facial muscles. And here, he integrates metta, loving kindness.
Uh-huh.
By visualizing a gentle smile and silently reciting phrases of loving kindness for yourself, loved ones, all beings as you scan the face.
That's lovely.
And continue down neck, shoulders, hands, the heart area. Just feel. Don't analyze or look for a heartbeat at first. Stomach, abdomen again, just silent feeling, not yet focusing on breath rising and falling. Buttocks, legs, then sweep back up.
So it anchors you in the body and brings in some positive feeling. What's next after the sweep?
Once the mind feels a bit quieter,
yeah,
a bit more settled from the sweeping, then you stabilize that awareness by anchoring it to a specific meditation object.
Like the breath.
Apanasati, mindfulness of breathing, is what's highly recommended here. And the key instruction remains, relax into whatever comes up. Don't fight thoughts or feelings. Just gently return to the breath.
And what happens potentially with this Anapanasati practice? What kind of transformation does the transcript describe?
Well, as you stay with the breath, with that relaxed awareness, the breath itself can become very subtle, very fine.
Okay.
And this can lead to piti arising. That's a kind of spiritual joy or peace.
Miti.
Which can then deepen into sukha, a real sense of bliss. And eventually, maybe pasadi.
Pasadi.
Deep tranquility, stillness. The transcript calls this the real meditative state.
And this pasadi, this stillness, it doesn't just stay on the cushion, right?
No, that's the beauty of it. When the mind finds that deep stillness, that clarity starts to seep into your whole day, it changes how you experience everything through your senses. Heedfulness becomes more natural.
So the formal sitting really fuels the informal everyday mindfulness. How does that integration look day to day?
It starts right when you finish meditating, coming out mindfully, trying to carry that peace and awareness with you.
Yeah.
And then it's about cultivating awareness of, well, everything, your movements, your actions, your speech, even your thoughts and feelings as they arise during the day. The transcript suggests this constant attention makes you kind of beautiful inside acting without that impulsive, heedless reactivity.
So daily life is the practice in a way.
Absolutely. That's where you cultivate the Noble Eightfold Path right in the middle of everything. Heedfulness, the transcript says, is defined by being constantly meditative and ever mindful.
It sounds like reflecting on the triple gem, the Buddha, Dhamma, Sakha, is also important for keeping this going.
Very important. The transcript stresses that regularly thinking about the meaning of the triple gem is essential for progress. And it goes into detail about the Sakha.
Not just monks and nuns in general.
More specifically, the Aryan Sakha. The community of enlightened or highly accomplished disciples.
And what are their key qualities?
Four are mentioned. Sutpipano, practicing well, good conduct. Ujjhupano, practicing uprightly, honestly, no deception.
Okay.
Dhyapipano, practicing wisely, in line with the Dhamma. And Samichipapano, practicing dutifully, fulfilling responsibilities according to natural law.
So it's a model for ethical and wise living.
Exactly. And understanding this helps us appreciate them as an incomparable field of merits, worthy of respect and support. But it's also a mirror for ourselves, isn't it?
How so?
It makes you ask, do I have these qualities? Am I cultivating good conduct, uprightness, wisdom, dutifulness in my own life?
That's a powerful reflection. The transcript also includes some personal stories, right? Like Christina's experience.
Yes. Those are really moving. Christina describes seeing bright light, feeling stillness in her heart area during meditation.
Wow.
It shows the potential when you practice with faith and understanding. Though importantly, the teaching also stresses not getting attached to even positive experiences like that. But her overall transformation, from suffering to joy through Dom practice, even without tons of formal sitting, is inspiring.
And Sister Serena finding peace despite physical pain.
Yeah, that's a fantastic example of understanding the hindrances in action. She didn't react with aversion to the discomfort and found stillness within it. That's real insight.
The idea of Kalyamita, spiritual friendship, also comes up.
It does. The transcript points out how vital, supportive, wise friends are on the path. And it mentions the Kalyamita Fund, highlighting the value of collective effort in supporting practice and spreading the teachings. There's a real sense of gratitude and also a reminder that these kinds of teachings are rare.
A window of opportunity.
Yes, urging people not to miss the chance for deep understanding.
Then the focus shifts a bit towards understanding life itself through this Buddhist lens.
Right. It emphasizes how crucial it is to see our lives through the framework of the Four Noble Truths and the Five Universal Orders, that the real secret of life is found there.
And it connects this to our understanding of time.
Yes, that's a key point. The past is gone. The future isn't here yet. The only reality is right now, this present moment.
But we miss it.
So often, we're too busy thinking, planning, worrying, complaining, living heedlessly, essentially. We miss the actual experience of being alive right now.
It all comes back to heedfulness again, doesn't it? Being present. And there's that Krishnamurti quote again at the end.
About individual change being the basis for world change.
Yes.
The power of the Dhamma is ultimately in transforming us, making us more mindful, more heedful, kinder, overcoming the negative stuff and growing the positive.
So as we wrap up this deep dive, what's the main takeaway you'd want someone listening to hold on to?
I think it's that closing encouragement from the transcript to really try to understand these teachings, to cultivate them diligently in your life, to realize their truth for yourself, and ultimately to awaken. And to remember that simple, powerful advice from the Buddha.
Avoid evil, do good.
Purify the mind. Actively heed that advice.
And there's a final piece of practical wisdom, too.
Yes, that reminder that with understanding and practice, life can become smoother, more fortunate. You develop the ability to handle things peacefully. And that core instruction for difficult moments. No matter what happens, don't get angry. Don't become miserable. Don't project your thought. Don't become fearful. Calm yourself down.
Simple but profound. Well, thank you for guiding us through this material. It gives us, and hopefully you listening, a lot to reflect on and explore further.